Good morning, and may it please the court. Judd Lonis, registration number 33208, on behalf of Manuel Martinez. Before I forget, Your Honor, if I have any time remaining, I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal. This morning, I'd like to discuss the search and seizure issue, although I'm willing to answer any questions the court has on the other issues raised. Your Honors, in this case, it is uncontested the defendant had standing. It's uncontested that a search and seizure occurred without a warrant. And therefore, the people have the burden of proving that the warrantless conduct on behalf of the police officers was constitutional. The court below presumed it was unconstitutional, and that was correct. There was no consent to search the apartment. The unrebutted testimony of the owner, Kim Love, proves that, and I've cited that in my reply brief. This was not a proper search pursuant to Maryland v. Buey under either type one or type two.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Lonis. I know you've just gotten out of the box, but let's assume for the purposes of argument that the record doesn't reflect why Mr. Martinez was arrested, that the status of the record is simply that he was seen in handcuffs in that back room. What results flow from that status?
That's an unconstitutional seizure.
But I think... Why don't you reply to the attenuation arguments, those sorts of things that the prosecution has made?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Your Honor, Mr. Martinez was placed in handcuffs in the back bedroom. He was taken out front of the apartment building. That unconscionable arrest placed him in front of the residence where the officers identified him as a suspect in the stabbing. All the evidence against him obtained as a direct result of that unconstitutional search and seizure that placed him on that curb in front of the apartment.
Can I ask you, Mr. Lonis, what evidence are we talking about here? And I won't keep you in suspense. I mean, where I'm driving at here is, does this matter? Let's assume, and I'm concerned about what happened here on this search. Assume everything you said is right. He admitted he did the stabbing. The issue here was self-defense. Does any of this evidence have anything to do with self-defense? Where's the harm? Even assuming everything you said is right, this was a totally unconstitutional search, seizure, and the like. Where's the harm? He conceded he's the one who stabbed the guy.
Yeah, Your Honor, the state they obtained the knife that he allegedly used in the stabbing. They obtained the jacket he allegedly wore, and they obtained his videotaped interview, which the people elected to introduce in their case in chief. And they relied heavily on that throughout the case to prove his guilt.
So you're saying the concession that he stabbed was really part of the people's evidence?
Absolutely. Your Honor, the people...
Did they introduce the jacket, counsel?
I'm not sure that... I think they introduced the fact that they found the jacket that matched. I think they had their testimony about the jacket. They found the jacket that matched. I'm not sure the jacket was actually introduced, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lonis. Let me make sure I understand. So your position here is that basically he conceded the stabbing and took the position on self-defense because that's what he was stuck with once this evidence came in. But your argument, I guess, is if none of this evidence was discovered or whatever, he wouldn't have been charged. He wouldn't have had to even take a position on self-defense. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And also, the statement that he made was damaging. And you'll see in my brief, I quoted the prosecution's brief where they said, everything you need to know about to show that his intent was to murder Stephen Lester is found in that statement. Now,
could we back up just a little bit?
Certainly, Your Honor.
In my question, I asked about attenuation, and let's focus on the statement.
Okay.
Would you address the prosecution's argument that there was sufficient attenuation between the assume for the purposes of argument the illegal arrest in the statement? Could you address that, please?
Yeah, Your Honor, basically there is no attenuation, and it comes down to this. As I previously stated, he was in the police car when he gave the false name. Okay, he was being taken downtown. The people have the burden of proving attenuation, and I submit to this court that in the end the question comes down to this: assuming he did not give a false name to the police officers, would the course of the detention investigation change one iota? Would the police have let him go and not conducted that custodial interrogation? Would they have not asked Ken Love to take a ride to the police station and therefore found the butterfly knife? Would they not have obtained a search warrant for that apartment? The answer is no, and the people cannot show otherwise. That's why they cannot prove attenuation. It's an after-the-fact justification for their prior unconstitutional conduct. Now, Doak is the leading case in Colorado on this. It's the Colorado Supreme Court case. This is the case in which some police officers were doing an admittedly unconstitutional search of a man's home. In response to that unconstitutional search, the defendant in Doak picked up a shotgun. He was subsequently charged with menacing based on brandishing that shotgun to the officers. As the Supreme Court put the question in that case, the case turns on the issue of whether a person confronted with an unreasonable search or seizure by a law enforcement officer may respond by threat of violence against the officer and then rely on the exclusionary rule to suppress evidence pertaining to that criminal act. Now, the Supreme Court answered no in that case. It was clear, but they repeatedly stated throughout that case that evidence of the new crime would not be suppressed. And that is what all the cases cited in my brief show, is that, and there, this comes up in many contexts, but for example, defendant is police suspect but have no probable cause that a defendant is possessing drugs. They go up and subject him to an unconstitutional arrest. The defendant reacts violently. He's therefore can't be charged with a resisting arrest. But even though the police find the cocaine after the resisting and after he's been put in a police car, the cocaine is considered fruits of that illegal arrest, and therefore it's suppressed. The new criminal act does not attenuate, does not break the causal chain.
Do you have a case that can show us that or tell us that, cited in your brief, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I can pull from my brief right now.
Never mind. It's in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I have done a brief treatment of Doak and then followed by several string sites. And it makes sense, Your Honor, because in that circumstance, the defendant is not given a free pass for his illegal conduct in response to the unconstitutional search. By the same token, the police are not given a free pass and allowed to go scot-free for their constitutional violation.
What about the development of probable cause to believe that Mr. Martinez was involved in the stabbing and to have independently be able to hold Mr. Martinez at the time of the statement? In other words, okay, he's out there perhaps by an illegal seizure, but someone fortuitously comes by, looks at him, says, gee, that might be a suspect in this case, does some further investigation and leads to a probable cause determination or belief that he was the suspect in the stabbing. If that were the case, could they not have arrested him independently on the stabbing and then questioned him without it being a fruit? Wouldn't that break the causal chain?
It would not, Your Honor, because the ID is the fruit.
And IDs are fruits of the poisonous tree?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe the case I've cited in my brief for that is People v. Lewis, wherein a convenience store was robbed. The person working at the convenience store was able to make an ID. They gave a description of the alleged robber. Sometime thereafter, the police basically went in and basically were gone on a fishing expedition at a local motel. They went in a room, took four men out of that hotel, put them out front. Okay.
Yep.
And then the police came by. Police drove the convenience store clerk by. They made the ID.
You're suppressing the ID, but is that different from saying, okay, later on you've got a statement that would have been related to probable cause based on this individual sitting in the public domain or standing in the public domain? I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, Your Honor, but again, it's a fruits. It's what it's part but cause, but it's also whether you have to look at the causal chain. And the fact is, the causal chain starts with that illegal arrest, puts him out front, and all the evidence obtained thereafter is from an unbroken causal chain. I don't think the fact that they, you know, you can't do an illegal search and then justify it because based on that illegal search, you then develop probable cause. I mean, there'd be no suppression rule or no right to illegal search and seizure.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical, Mr. Lonis. Assume for the purposes of argument that the police took Mr. Martinez outside, and instead of an officer who was familiar with the case, there was a press photographer who takes a photograph, and the photograph is published in the paper the next day. And someone looks at the paper and says, that's the person who was involved in that stabbing, and goes to the police and provides that information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is your argument the same?
I would argue that, yeah, that's just an unbroken causal chain. But I would also, my first argument is that's not what happened here. Another police officer drove by and said, hey, who's that guy? He looks like someone we're interested in on this stab.
But how is that different?
Because it's government conduct. And you might, whenever there's, the question is attenuation, Your Honor, the word attenuation assumes, you know, time breaks the causal chain. If you have to pile inference upon inference, the causal chain is less strong and the reasons for suppression grow weaker. But here, it's direct. He's in front of the apartment, he's identified, and then they put him in the police car to take him downtown. The whole investigation is underway at that point.
But how is it direct, Mr. Lonis, when the officer came by, it had nothing to do with this? I mean, as I understood it, the officer just kind of, whether it's coincidence or whatever, came by and said, that guy matches the description, which strikes me as different than Lewis, where, you know, they're investigating this very issue and they go across the street and go get the folks who were robbed at 7-Eleven and bring them right then. There was nothing that happened coincidentally in Lewis. I mean, they went and got the person to check. It seemed to me that this police officer didn't come by to investigate the stabbing, as I understand it. If I have those facts wrong, correct me. The other thing, if you could address, it just strikes me, and I recognize there's a fine line between, is this but for cause or unbroken chain, and I'm not sure what the difference is or where the line is. The Supreme Court in Doak and other cases have said it's not strictly but for, but it feels to me like you may be arguing but for.
I'm not arguing but for, Your Honor. Okay. It's an unbroken causal chain.
So what's the difference? So two questions. If you could just tell me the distinction between Lewis and this, or why is Lewis the same as this case? And then two, what's the difference between unbroken chain and but for?
There's some ambiguity in language, but it always comes down to the language in Wan Sung is whether it's come at by exploitation of the primary illegality or instead by a means sufficiently distinguishable to be purged of the primary taint. You know, I have to say that the facts of this case, as reported by the police officers, seem a little bit incredible, but that's the facts we have, that it was just a coincidence. But what I would say is when you're looking at suppression, you have to look at the Supreme Court cases, U.S. Supreme Court. We have Brown v. Illinois. We have the Taylor case cited in my briefs. These are cases where, and Brown v. Illinois is the seminal case on suppression of statements based on illegal arrest. In that case, the defendant actually gave a false name after being arrested. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is that's not the court just states it in the facts, but it's not it doesn't go into their attenuation analysis whatsoever. It's really irrelevant to attenuation, and they obviously feel it does not break the causal chain. That was a break of several hours before the confession was obtained. In Taylor, it was about 6 hours. In that case, and in Taylor, the defendant was actually allowed to visit with relatives and girlfriends before he made his incriminating statement. So, you know, the mere fact that he's taken down to the police station to be by other officers, as Professor Lefebvre said, does not wash the officer's hands. Doesn't clean the slate. And I think if you just go back to that language in Wong Sung, it's not sufficiently attenuated. It
it's an unbroken causal chain. And I understand that's an evaluation the court must make. It's somewhat subjective, but if you look at the facts, I think it comes down to what I previously said. The course of the investigation would not have changed one iota had Mr. Martinez not made that false statement. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. I'm going to ask the bailiff to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal in case there's any other issue that may also be discussed during the people's argument, but you'll get 2 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you.
Okay. And if the people need it, you'll get 17 minutes as well.
Before you start, counsel, I know a bunch of people just came in and I heard somebody's cell phone. Could you all make sure that your cell phones are off? Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. This case has a number of different police officers who testified about the contact with a number of different individuals in this apartment. It is an odd suppression hearing because we didn't wind up with testimony from the officer who initially contacted the defendant, Officer Anich. We do have testimony from his partner, Officer Kafer. Also, it is my memory, counsel said that there was unrebutted testimony from Kim Love, the renter of the apartment, and my memory is that he did not testify at the suppression hearing, that he testified later at trial, but not at the suppression hearing. Another point that I think I would say he said was uncontested, and I would say that I would not agree, was he says that it's uncontested that a search of the apartment occurred without a warrant, and my position was that the search occurred after a warrant.
Well, let me ask you about this. Isn't there testimony from the officer that there was a search incident to arrest in the apartment?
I believe there was a search of the defendant's person, but that didn't lead to any evidence that we're talking about here.
Did it not convert? If it was a permissible stop, did it not convert that into an impermissible or illegal arrest, an illegal seizure?
Your Honor, that's a seizure issue, not talking about the search of the apartment.
No, and I'm talking about, was there a search without a warrant of the person in the apartment without probable cause?
Your Honor, I would agree that there was, in fact, a search without a warrant of the defendant's person, but I don't see any search of the defendant's person as being relevant here because there was no evidence obtained.
Well, wait a second. Excuse me.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead, Judge.
Can you not have a fruit of an illegal seizure as much as or as well as a fruit of an illegal search?
Your Honor, you can. I'm just saying that the search of the premises of the apartment was only conducted pursuant to a warrant. And it was pursuant to that warrant search that the items of evidence at issue here were obtained.
After quite a bit of earlier I don't know what the right word I would say, not falderal, but after a lot of earlier facts or acts had occurred, the warrant was obtained after a lot of prior events had occurred.
That is correct.
And the question then is, okay, before we get to the warrant, I think you've got to justify a few other links.
Your Honor, I certainly believe that the prosecution has the burden to justify at a suppression hearing. And I would agree that I have to show some links with regard to the seizure of the defendant and the defendant's statements. However, I don't think that there is a linkage between the defendant's seizure and the items that were taken from the apartment.
Well, let me suggest the linkage. The defendant is somehow identified fairly quickly outside the apartment as perhaps being involved in this stabbing. And I believe the suppression hearing says, Mr. Love, don't you want to come downtown to talk to us about any knowledge you may have about the stabbing? You don't think there's any connection between the seizure of Mr. Martinez and essentially Mr. Love's going downtown or asking the officer to go back and see things, which then led to a warrant?
Your Honor, I think this is part of an ongoing consensual contact with Love. Because if we look at the evidence in the case, we have the testimony of Officer Kafer. Officer Kafer testifies that they knock on the door and they are permitted into the apartment by Love. This is a consensual contact with Love, who permits the officers into the apartment.
What evidence was there, Ms. Rawbar, that Mr. Love then said, you can go ahead and walk down the hall and go into the bedroom? I mean, you're arguing, I guess I'm trying to get to, you know, you're arguing protective sweep here. It's not clear to me why walking down a long hallway into the bedroom is an incident to the arrest of Mr. Harms. So you got to get to some kind of articulable suspicion, seems to me, to walk down the hall. And I didn't see in your brief or anywhere in the record any evidence that there was concern about officer safety. Mr. Harms was arrested and gone. And so that's, you know, a part of this link that causes me concern as well.
Your Honor, I believe your question has multiple parts. So I would like to address these multiple parts. I would say
it was a compound question.
I would say at the outset that I don't think that there is any evidence that the hallway involved was either long or short, merely that there was a hallway between the so-called front room of the apartment and the single back bedroom. So the long, I do believe, is a gloss. Now, in response to your question, I wanted to talk about two different things. The first is the protective sweep, which is under Maryland v. Bowie. And under Maryland v. Bowie, counsel and I both agreed that there are two types of protective sweeps that are permitted under that case. The second is where there's reasonable suspicion.
Has our Supreme Court read it that way? Has our Supreme Court read Maryland versus Bowie to have two types of protective sweeps?
Your Honor, I don't believe our Supreme Court has opined upon this. I'm relying on the U.S. Supreme Court case.
And I'd ask, aren't there a couple state Supreme Court cases on protective sweeps, and don't they suggest you have to have some kind of reasonable suspicion of danger?
Your Honor, I think that is what we call a Type 2 buoy search.
And did the Supreme Court, in its discussion of what you call a Type 2 buoy search, did the state Supreme Court acknowledge that there is such a thing as a Type 1 buoy search?
That's what I'm saying. That I understand, and counsel and I have both talked in my brief about Type 1 searches and Type 2 searches. So I am not arguing that this is a Type 2 search that is supported by reasonable suspicion. I am arguing that this is what is described in Bowie as without articulable suspicion as a precautionary matter. Officers may look into areas immediately adjoining the place of arrest from which an attack could be immediately launched.
So what evidence, you just told me it's not clear whether it's a long hallway. I think this goes both ways. What evidence is there that that room was immediately adjoining?
The evidence that I have that was immediately adjoining comes from Officer Kafer's testimony. On page 53 of the suppression hearing, he said, Officer Anich noticed there was someone else in the room off the room we were in and had walked into that room to speak with him. So that implies that this is the room immediately adjoining the room off the room we were in, and that he went right back there to talk to him. And another aspect of your question, Judge Gabriel, had to do with the time consideration. And I think with regard to time consideration, what the record shows, as I said, is that there are several contacts between several individuals and the officers going on fairly simultaneously. The officer...
The record doesn't show whether or not Mr. Harms had been removed or not, does it?
No, it does not show whether he'd been removed or not, and we don't have factual findings.
Whose burden was it to show that he had not been removed?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's one question about whether he had or had not been removed, but I think it's not the removal that matters so much as the initiation of the contact, because it seems to me a fair reading of the record is that the officers, and there were many of them, walk into the apartment. The one officer, Officer Kafer, talks to Love. At the same time, Officer Amich is going back into the back room to talk to the defendant. A third officer is talking to Harms, the individual who had the warrant. Now, what happened is, as I said, these three things seem to be going on simultaneously. And it might have been that Harms would not have been removed before the contact concluded, except for the fact that Rivera was hiding in the closet. I think that the contact started before Harms was removed, and he was removed at some point.
It doesn't show, the record doesn't show the contact started before Harms was removed, does it? Can you point me to a place in the record where it shows that the contact was made before Harms was removed from the scene?
All I can say is that I think that is an inference based on the number of officers who entered and the way they triangulated in speaking to these people. But I don't have any evidence directly in terms of the timeline.
Pardon me, Ms. Rohrbaum. I want to go back to where we started with you. Because we've got a hole in the record, as you mentioned in your at the beginning of your statements. We don't know why suddenly Mr. Martinez is there in handcuffs. Because we don't know why, we have no evidence to suggest that he was a problem, that Officer Anich saw criminal activity, or that Officer Anich thought that he provided a threat. We don't know. Thus, because of that problem, we have the following, and you tell me if this reasoning is wrong. It is not until they see and contact and discover who Mr. Martinez is that that warrant even becomes worthy, because they're there for another reason entirely. It is Mr. Martinez's presence and identification that ends up prompting the warrant. And if his presence and identification is illegal, and we do not know otherwise, then don't we have the problem that Judge Daly was talking with you about, that there's a problem before the warrant that the warrant doesn't necessarily expunge?
Well, Your Honor, we have a series of contacts with the defendant and a series of justifications or likely justifications for them. The first is the fact that the officer goes into the back room, and I didn't quite get to the final part of my response to Judge Gabriel, which was that the officers entered with the consent of Kim Love. The officer was told by Kim Love that there were two people in the back room. We clearly have a consent to enter the apartment. The question is, what are the time and space limitations of Love's consent?
There's no indication that Love said, sure, go on back there.
That's correct. I don't have actual testimony that Love said, go on back there. But I have testimony that Love said there were two people in the back room, and he later told the officer to go retrieve his shoes from the back room.
After he was asked to come down to the station and discuss his knowledge about Mr. Martinez's involvement in the stabbing.
Right, but this is, as I said, part of the consensual contact of the officers with Love. Now, to return to Judge Bernard's question, it's true we don't know why the defendant was originally placed in handcuffs. Officer Amich was that officer. Officer Kafer testified that he assumed that either it was for officer safety purposes or that the officer had observed some criminal behavior. That, of course, is not particularly helpful in this analysis. As I indicated in talking about Bowie, it seems that the officers could reach a protective sweep without reasonable suspicion, and I think could handcuff a person for reasons of officer safety, but we just don't know. Oh. Moving on.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The question of false information. We have Officer Amich saying to Officer Kafer that he was unsure of the name that the defendant was giving. This is our first indication that there may be false information involved. Detective Jeffers testified that he had been told by other officers the defendant was in custody for false information. Finally, we have the testimony of Officer Engelbert. Officer Engelbert testified he took custody of the defendant from Detective Vasquez, who told me to figure out who this person was. At that point, the defendant identified himself as Carlos Lopez with a particular date of birth. No information was found on such an individual. He talked to Harms, who said that he knew the defendant as Mario and possibly he had a warrant for his arrest. So all of these circumstances show a continuing investigation into the defendant's giving false information. I would also like to stress to this court.
Are you suggesting that that would attenuate any taint of any illegality? You might want to get to attenuation at some point.
Yes, Your Honor, because I see I have 1 minute and 7 seconds left. And I would like to talk about that. And I think the thing that wraps up the attenuation more than anything else is that by the time he is interviewed that evening at the police station, he has been found to have had an outstanding warrant. And I would say that that outstanding warrant is an unexpected circumstance, intervening circumstance, that breaks the chain of any taint. Because by the time he's interviewed, they know his real name by then and know that he has an arrest warrant under that name. And this is a circumstance that's absolutely unrelated to any illegality of his contact with the police.
But when you break the chain, doesn't that, or in this case, he was charged with another crime, making a false statement to the police. Doesn't that then allow you to ask questions about that other crime? But it doesn't, you know, erase an illegal search and the fruits of that. So to the extent there was evidence developed relating to the false reporting, I can understand how that breaks the chain, and all that's fair game at this point. But I'm not sure how that suddenly rectifies everything that happened before.
Your Honor, I don't know if Judge Daly would be willing to give me a little more time to respond to your question.
Judge Daly is going to give you at least 3 minutes, hold the phone there. Don't run the clock while I'm giving some more minutes, please. I'm going to give you 3 minutes. I'm going to make sure you'll get time, Mr. Lomas, because one of the things Judge Daly wants to discuss in addition to attenuation is juror BS. Juror BS seems to have a problem. Juror BS indicated he would have a hard time applying the presumption of innocence if the defendant did not testify. Now, you've got 3 minutes. Why don't you stay with attenuation and try to figure out how to address BS? Now, please start.
Your Honor, with regard to attenuation, as I said, the factors include the presence of intervening circumstances, and I would submit to you that this outstanding arrest warrant would be an intervening circumstance. Also, this contact at the apartment took place in the early afternoon, and he wasn't interviewed into the early evening. And also, my position is that the officer's conduct was not flagrant. The best we can say is that officer safety concerns would be at issue and that they acted properly. There's certainly nothing in the record to show that there was any insidious intent. I wanted to say about the attenuation issue that I think this case can be distinguished from the Lewis case, where individuals were brought to identify the defendant in custody, because here, at the point in time that there was this identification of the defendant by the passing detective, there was already a description of the defendant as Mario and of his girlfriend as Butterfly as the people involved in the stabbing the night before. Both Luster and Luster's friend had made this identification and described the defendant. They were not brought to the scene, so we have this independent information that the defendant was a person involved in the stabbing, and it was just happenstance that this particular detective came by. I also think that this case is very different from a drug case, because in a drug case where there's been perhaps an illegal seizure and then drugs are found, that then is a crime and evidence that is discovered subsequent to the illegality. Here, this crime happened before. It was the night before. It involved this stabbing. There were eyewitness accounts of the stabbing from the friend of Luster. I guess Luster wasn't actually in a position to make a statement because he was so badly wounded at the time. With regard to BS, the juror in question, we have a situation where the trial court is making a credibility determination among various statements that a prospective juror has made. So in this situation, that is something that we give to the trial court to decide among various statements. So during voir dire with this individual, BS stated that he didn't understand why a defendant would not want to testify, but he also said that he understood the presumption of innocence.
But where's the, and excuse me for interrupting because I know your time's limited. I understand, he said, I understand there's a presumption of innocence, but I'm going to have a lot of trouble applying it here. What is inconsistent with that? Don't you have to rehabilitate that? So, yeah, I understand, he got it, but I can't apply it. And I never heard or saw on the record any rehabilitation after that. Don't you have to rehabilitate on that? I'm not going to apply it, even though I understand it exists.
Your Honor, Vecchiarelli McLaughlin stands for the proposition that it's not the last thing that the juror says that is determinative.
So what,
it is the
what
record
anywhere,
as a whole.
But what anywhere in the record suggests that this man would be able to get past his problem applying the presumption of innocence?
On pages 164 and 165, he says that he knows it's the defendant's right not to testify and that he is innocent.
Do you think he meant he's innocent or he's presumed innocent?
I think he meant by that presumed innocence, because that was part of the discussion.
Yeah, but in addition to Judge Gabriel's question, don't we have the problem with the question, because you are going to think that's strange and you would expect that someone who was innocent would take the stand and testify, if he doesn't, do you think you might hold that against him or that he's hiding something? Answer, I think the latter, not the former. Why on earth would he not want to testify? What is it he doesn't want to talk about? I think the latter, not the former, means that he thinks he's hiding something if he doesn't testify.
Your Honor, it's only the trial judge who could observe the demeanor and make findings about which of the prospective jurors' various statements were the most credible. And we place this within the trial court's discretion.
But did the judge make those findings? The judge made the finding basically only because he acknowledged that the defendant had a right not to testify. Not that he acknowledged that he wouldn't be penalized in any way if he did not testify.
Your Honor, I think that's part and parcel of the same, that he did say that he acknowledged the defendant had a right to testify and he would be so instructed.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Please give appellant's counsel 5 minutes, because that's about how much time we interrogated you, Ms. Rohrabacher.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I briefly want to readdress the search issue. Counsel made mention of a warrant breaking the causal chain. And what happened is one of the officers at the suppression hearing testified. We found Mr. Martinez's true name, and we found he had a warrant. And that's all we hear about that, okay? That it doesn't play, for one thing, the officers don't explain how that changed the course of the investigation whatsoever. We also don't have any testimony what that warrant's for.
But isn't that an intervening circumstance that allowed the police to independently have Mr. Martinez in custody such that they could then question him?
But they wouldn't have questioned about the stabbing. And furthermore, since we don't know what kind of warrant it is, we don't know whether it would have allowed them to keep him in custody. It could have been
Are you saying, counsel, that if you arrest you on a warrant, you cannot discuss with, you're not permitted to discuss with the suspect any other crimes of which he may have been suspected of committing?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the record is not that he was arrested on warrant, is that they found he had a warrant.
That's right. But if he is in custody on a warrant, maybe he may have been illegally in custody originally, but if he's in custody on a warrant, are you saying you can't question him about other crimes for which he may be a suspect?
You may, but the question in this case is whether it breaks the causal chain.
Well, let me try a different approach here, Mr. Lonis. We know he made a false statement. He was arrested for that, at least, even though he may have been arrested before with no reason whatsoever. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he did make a false statement. He's then placed under arrest.
Yes.
I mean, once he's under arrest for that, when the police gets to the police station, they check there's an outstanding warrant. They could question him about that, right? Wouldn't that break the causal chain?
If there is an outstanding
warrant. So he's validly under arrest for filing a false statement. Now he's in custody. They figure out there's a warrant outstanding. Why can't they ask him about anything else?
Well, Your Honor, because it's just the happenstance that he happens to have a warrant does not purge the taint of the fact that these police officers blatantly went into an apartment in a low rent area and did a shakedown to see what they could stir up. They were looking for evidence of crime, and they just shook it down, put people on the curb, saw what they could find out. That's flagrantly unconstitutional. It's not okay. And
all the evidence in the case flowed from that flagrantly illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional encounter.
But that sounds like but-for causation to me. Your argument is striking me as, but for the fact of this illegality, he never would have been on the curb. This other cop would never have come by and recognized him. He never would have been arrested, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where is the, you know, using the illegal evidence or taking advantage of that when he's validly arrested for a false statement and then he's questioned?
Because the false statement had nothing to do with it, Your Honor. As I said, remove the false statement from the equation and tell me what changes. That's the burden they have on attenuation, and nothing changes. Now, I'd like to briefly address juror BS. And, Your Honor, I quoted extensively from pages 164 to 165 in my opening brief. I respectfully believe it shows something different than counsel's recitation here today. The questions revolved around the right to testify in this particular case where self-defense would be raised. And he said, well, I understand he has a right not to testify, but in this case, if he's there, he's claiming self-defense, I want to hear from him. And this, and what he said is, so the counsel asked, right, so if he doesn't take the stand and tell you what happened, are you going to have this feeling that, you know, he's more likely guilty because he didn't come and tell me what happened? And then he says, juror BS says, well, I'm certainly going to want to hear that, not going to want to hear that from you. You're his attorney. You're not him. Okay, if he doesn't take the stand, do you think you might have a feeling that he's likely guilty because he didn't get up and say, this is what happened? His answer is, it would be hard for me to maintain the presumption of innocence under that set of circumstances. That's the set of circumstances in our case. It's going to be hard for him to maintain. It doesn't matter if he can be fair in another case. He can't maintain the presumption of innocence in this case. That's why it was a valid challenge for cause, and that's why the judge should have granted it. Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments in this case. Pretty thorny issues. You've been very helpful to us. The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both very much.